So, Mr. Johnson, would you move with the next item?
Robertson.
Oh.
Mr. Robertson, well, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You promoted me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it's
kind of scary.
You have a job now.
It's a major.
Want a trade?
I'm retired. Thank you very much.
Want a trade?
No.
All right.
Sorry. Shows how the brain sometimes works.
Okay. So this is a groundwater quality conditions and ag discharges in the Central Coast region. You'll recall at the March board meeting, we talked about surface water quality conditions. That was the theme. We're flipping over and doing groundwater with this meeting thematically. Just as a reminder, so this is not a discussion of 4.0 or potential requirements of 4.0 or not a regressive analysis of 3.0 either. We didn't agendize it as such. This is really just looking at snapshots of different aspects of groundwater and then associated discussion of nitrate monitoring capabilities and management practices. The staff report for this item is divided into two primary parts. Part one provides an overview of groundwater quality conditions on the Central Coast for compounds including nitrate, salts, industrial chemicals, arsenic, and pesticides. And part one will primarily be covered today. Part two of the staff report provides an overview of the nitrogen application data required by Ag Orders 2.0 and 3.0, and an estimation of nitrate loading in groundwater from current ag discharges. And part two will take place tomorrow, primarily. Okay, similar to the March board meeting, the board will hear presentations from various experts, including our own staff, Central Coast staff, and a number of guest speakers collected from around the region and the state. Today we'll have three presentations, two of which focus on groundwater quality conditions. And I actually should say three because Perry Clausen of CCGC actually asked for some time, and we're going to integrate Perry into the groundwater quality discussion, his presentation. The third covers basin scale groundwater monitoring systems, kind of where we're headed ultimately through the lens of SGMA and oil field associated oil field monitoring, these dedicated monitoring systems, not happenstance because we have a well here, but smart designed monitoring systems. And then tomorrow we'll have four additional presentations with a focus on nitrogen loading and irrigation management. In terms of efficiency, we thought it best to let the presentations run, let the presenters complete their presentation, and then allow the board the opportunity then with each presenter to work questions through. And then at the conclusion of all of them, maybe have a broader discussion if the board wants to there. And with that, I think I'll hand it over to Angela Schroeder. And Angela will introduce the speakers.
Good afternoon, Chair Wolf, members of the board. My name is Angela Schroeder, supervising engineering geologist here at the regional board. As John mentioned, we're going to have several speakers today to discuss groundwater quality conditions, pesticides in groundwater, and also basin scale monitoring. First, we'll hear from our own staff, James Bishop. James is an engineering geologist and has been with the Water Board since last August. He works in both the irrigated lands and cannabis programs. And prior to the Water Board, James worked as a geologist and a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Santa Cruz and Menlo Park. James has a bachelor's degree in geology and a master's degree in hydrogeology, both from the University of Hawaii. James will present information today on groundwater quality conditions, including a more detailed review of the data of nitrate data in agricultural areas. So with that, I'll hand it to James.
Thanks for that introduction, Angela. Chair, members of the board, good afternoon. My name is James Bishop, as Angela just noted. And I'm going to be presenting today on part one of item 8, which is really the groundwater quality conditions. Arwen is going to present tomorrow on agricultural discharges. Before I get going, I just want to acknowledge some of the staff that helped me in this work. Leah Lemoyne did an excellent salinity analysis. I've included part of that analysis in this talk. Arwen, Wyatt Mayer, Monica Baracarte, Angela Schrader, and Dean Thomas all provided quite a bit of assistance. And Steve Size provided a lot of assistance with respect to statistical analysis and interpretation. So with that, I'll get going here. Roughly, this is what I'm going to go over in the presentation today. I'm going to give a brief overview of contaminants region-wide, and then I'm going to spend a couple of slides discussing salinity, and then spend most of the talk discussing nitrate with respect to the current nitrate concentrations in groundwater basins, and then I'm going to discuss changes in nitrate concentrations through time. So I'm going to start off by just putting out, getting to the punchline effectively and stating what are the key findings. And these are the things that I hope that you folks will take home with you at the end of today's presentation. And so first of all, nitrate and salinity are the biggest threats to groundwater quality in the Central Coast, right? And the reasoning for that is basically bullet point number two, which is that nitrate and salinity impairment are incredibly widespread, affecting many basins and large portions of those basins in the region. And the concentrations are high and the impacts are severe. I suspect that points one and two are not new information to you folks. This is kind of old news. I think that the third bullet point here, that nitrate concentrations are increasing, this is some new analysis we've done, and I think this will be really interesting and compelling for you folks. So when we first started looking and prioritizing contaminants in the region, we took a broad look at what are the contaminants that we see occurring or exceeding their reference concentrations most frequently in wells. And a handful of contaminants kind of shook out in terms of ranking highly. And after that ranking, we kind of prioritized them internally. And basically, we decided that salinity and nitrate were of utmost importance. But some of the contaminants that did rank highly include iron, manganese, and arsenic. However, we did not rank these as highly as salinity and nitrate because these are primarily naturally occurring contaminants, and source control is largely not feasible. These contaminants occur in the geologic materials that make up the aquifers. Benzene, hexavalent chromium, and MTBE also ranked highly in terms of our analysis. However, these are, if not entirely, at least partially sourced from anthropogenic activities. However, they tend to be much more localized in occurrence. They're not super widespread like nitrate and salinity. And they're also already heavily regulated by a number of programs in the Water Board and remediated. Comparing these two groups with nitrate and salinity are really widespread, as I mentioned. They occur in high concentrations. Nitrate is a threat to human health, and there's very little regulation controlling the source, and there's very little remediation done with respect to nitrate and salinity. I've also included pesticides as a question mark, and basically, pesticides are a big data gap for us. There's very few wells sampled for pesticides, and as such, we have very few detections, but there's also a lot of pesticides that have the potential for leaching to groundwater, and so it's hard to know which pesticides to even sample for. I'm not going to delve real deep into pesticides. Cheryl Gill is going to get into that here later today, and I'll let her discuss this more in depth. So this first slide I'm showing is a map of salinity concentrations in wells, right? So the dots on this map indicate individual well locations, and the color of these dots indicates the mean concentration measured in those wells between 2009 and 2018. And these are domestic and public supply wells. So these are wells that people are drinking from. The color scheme on this, green indicates concentrations from 0 to 500 milligrams per liter. 500 milligrams per liter is the secondary MCL at which taste starts to become affected by salinity. Everything that's not green exceeds that secondary MCL. And so, I mean, there's a couple of extremely obvious things that you can see here, which are that there's a lot of non-green points. There's a lot of wells that are exceeding the secondary MCL. There's exceedances in nearly every basin, every major basin in the region, and the exceedances occur over really large areas of these basins. I guess the second point is we've got a lot of data. I mean, we've got excellent spatial coverage, and there's not a lot of question about whether this data is representing the basins very well. It probably is representing what's going on very well. This next slide is showing is similar to what I just showed, except this is for agricultural and irrigation supply wells. And the color scheme is slightly different. Now green goes up to 640 milligrams per liter. 640 milligrams per liter is the concentration at which salt-sensitive crops start to experience decreases in yields. And so, again, the pattern is much the same. You see large swaths of many of the basins with non-green colors indicating exceedances, Salinas Valley, Gilroy-Hollister Valley, Paso Basin, Santa Maria Valley, San Ynez Valley, really all the major basins in the region that have data are showing exceedances. And so we know that there's a variety of different sources of salinity, both naturally occurring and anthropogenic, right? Some of the naturally occurring sources are near the coast or seawater intrusion, aerial salt deposition, and then some of the basins are comprised of marine sediments and have naturally occurring salt. But we also know from many well-documented studies in the Central Valley that agricultural practices can contribute large amounts of salinity to groundwater and severely impact groundwater resources. And we have no reason to believe that agricultural practices on the Central Coast aren't resulting in a similar effect. So because there are so many naturally occurring sources of salt in the Central Coast, we need to limit additions of salt as much as we can. And so with that, that's all I'm going to say about salt. We'll probably discuss this more at a later board meeting. I'm going to move on and spend the rest of this talk discussing nitrate. Yes,
go
ahead.
Question. You mentioned the secondary MCL. Can you just quickly define the difference between the MCL and the secondary MCL in case people aren't familiar with that term?
Yes, excellent point. Secondary MCL is basically an aesthetic MCL. It's the concentration at which some aesthetic aspect of the water is affected, such as color, odor, taste. And in the case of salinity, it's the taste. All right, so moving on to groundwater. I'm going to first discuss current concentrations, current nitrate concentrations. And so my analysis of current nitrate concentrations utilizes two data sets. One data set that I'm calling all wells and uses all well types in the region. Real creative name. The benefit of using all well types in the region is that you're getting deep wells, you're getting shallow wells, and everything in between. And so you're getting a basically top-to-bottom picture in the aquifer of groundwater concentrations. It's really a comprehensive picture of what's going on. And this data set includes almost 50,000 samples from nearly 10,000 wells between 2009 and 2018. Oops. Can you set me back up there? All right. The second data set we looked at are domestic wells, and so these are domestic wells from the Irrigated Lands Program. And so the benefit of looking at just these wells is they tend to be drilled and screened shallow. And so you're looking at shallow portions of the basin, right? And the shallow portions of the aquifer represent young groundwater and reflect recent land use practices, because that shallow portion of the aquifer has the most direct connectivity with the ground above it and the land use practices above it. So you're looking at recent land use practices. Because these are domestic wells, you're looking at impacts to human health. And because this comes from the Irrigated Lands Program, you're looking at impacts in agricultural areas. And this data set includes about 5,000 samples from about 2,400 wells. And just a bit of housekeeping, all data is presented as nitrate N with an MCL of 10 milligrams per liter. All right, so this first map is showing the mean nitrate concentration in this all-well data set between 2009 and 2018. So the bubbles on here indicate individual well locations. The colors of the bubbles indicate the mean concentration measured in that well. And so the scale, blue, is for concentrations from 0 to 10 milligrams per liter, 10 milligrams per liter being the MCL. Everything that's not blue exceeds the MCL. So again, the two real obvious things that stand out here are that, A, there's a lot of data. We can characterize most of these basins incredibly well. And B, there's a lot of warm colors indicating lots of exceedances of the MCL. Salinas Valley is lots of exceedances. Corralitos Pajaro Valley, Gilroy-Hollister Valley, and almost a bullseye-looking effect here in Santa Maria. So because there is so much data, we don't need to do a lot of interpolation. It's just the data is what it is, right? All right. So this slide provides basically a summary of the slide I just showed for each basin. Because there is so much variability, it's hard to get a sense of what is kind of the central tendency for each of these basins. And so what I'm showing is here is the percent of wells above the MCL for this all wells data set. So warm colors indicate a greater number of wells above the MCL. I just want to point out this Carrizo Basin, we only have about 10 wells for this basin, so this data display is probably not a good indicator for this basin, but for most of the other basins in the region, we have excellent well coverage, and this type of symbology does a nice job of summarizing. So the things that stand out here, of course, the warm colors in Santa Maria, many of the sub-basins within the Salinas Valley. And these are indicating, the red is indicating that 50% or more of the wells exceed the MCL, one out of every two wells. For the Santa Maria Valley, it's more than 40% of the wells exceed the MCL, so nearly one out of every two wells. So moving on, I'm going to discuss, so this is a map for domestic wells, and it's the same concept of what I showed in two slides ago. The wells are shown by the bubbles, and the concentrations, mean concentration, is shown by the colors. And again, the pattern is very similar in that you've got lots of exceedances throughout the Salinas Valley, in the Corralitos Pajaro Valley, Gilroy Hollister Valley, and Santa Maria. There are a couple of basins that are actually in pretty good, relatively good shape in terms of nitrate water quality, which would be, of course, this big blue blob in the middle, which is the Paso Basin, and the east side of the Santa Ynez Basin looks pretty good. So here's a summary slide for domestic wells. And so one of the things I want to point out is that the pattern looks very similar to the all wells data set. However, the number of wells that exceed the MCL is shifted towards higher percentages for nearly every basin. So this is indicating that the part of the aquifer tapped by domestic wells is more impacted than the basin as a whole. And this is concerning because this is the part of the aquifer where these people are drinking water from, right? And so in the Salinas Valley, it's showing that more than 50% of the wells in three of the sub-basins exceed the MCL, exceed the human health standard. Corralitos Pajaro Valley, you're seeing about one in every three wells exceed the human health standard. In Gilroy Hollister Valley, you're seeing, you know, between one in three and one out of every two wells exceeds the human health standard. And in Santa Maria, it's more than 40% of the wells. So these findings are not necessarily original. I mean, Matt Keeling showed similar results in 2014 with his analysis. Many other researchers have showed similar results for basins throughout the region. The difference now is that we just got a lot more data that basically confirms what we already knew and paints a much, you know, we're much more confident about the results. So really the question in my mind is, are things getting better or are things getting worse? Because we know things are already severely impacted. And so the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus on discussing our analysis of changes in concentration through time. So we looked at nitrate concentration changes through time in three ways. We did a trend analysis, and trend analysis is kind of the golden standard for how to assess changes in groundwater conditions. It's used throughout the world to do exactly what I'm about to show you folks. I also did two other analyses, a paired sample comparison and a grouped comparison. And I did these because I wanted to utilize the irrigated lands regulatory program data that has been required for growers to collect, right? They were required to submit samples in 2012 and 2017. We wanted to use that data. It's valuable. The only caveat is you basically have two points in time. You have a 2012 sample and a 2017 sample, so its utility is somewhat limited. However, we also wanted to see if these two approaches could confirm what we're seeing in the trend analysis. So first, the trend analysis, the way this is done is you test for a statistically significant trend in nitrate concentration through time in a single well. This test needs a minimum of five samples per well, and so as a result, you're primarily testing public supply wells because these wells have long data records. And also, these wells tend to be drilled and drilled really deep and screen and have really long screened intervals. And so you're incorporating a lot of deep, clean water, kind of biasing the result towards lower concentrations. This has very few irrigated lands program wells because they just don't have the number of data or number of samples needed. But out of the 10,000 wells in the region, 1,400 met the criteria needed for the test, and 365 had statistically significant trends. And this includes data from 2009 to 2018. So this map shows the results of the trend analysis. The bubbles, so this map on the left is for basins in the northern region. The map on the right is for basins in the southern region. And the bubbles show the location of wells with statistically significant trends. The color of the bubble indicates the slope of the trend, or in other words, how quickly concentration is changing through time. Your dark red indicates concentrations are increasing quickly. This light red or pink indicates concentrations are increasing slowly. Light blue indicates concentrations are decreasing slowly, and dark blue indicates concentrations are decreasing quickly. The size of the bubble indicates the median concentration in that well. So you're getting two pieces of information. You're getting the concentration in the well and how quickly it's changing. And so what you can see is that there's a lot of dark red bubbles, dark red big bubbles, indicating high concentrations that are increasing quickly, particularly in the Salinas Valley, Coralitos Pajaro Valley, and Santa Maria, which, of course, are basins that we're already seeing severe impacts in. So not only are concentrations increasing quickly, they're increasing quickly in basins that have severe nitrate impacts. Interestingly, there are a few basins that appear to be improving. The Llagas Basin up here has this cluster of slowly decreasing wells, which is awesome. Vanessa Della Piedra from Santa Clara Valley Water District is going to present shortly. Maybe she can touch on why that is. But in general, it appears concentrations are increasing throughout the region.
So, you know, maybe the next speaker will address this, but almost at least on the map, next to a well where you have significant increase, you have another one showing a decrease.
I think
warrants, you know, a little further review, because you made the statement that, well, you know, in general there's an increase, but amongst those I see some wells with a decrease. So, you know, it's not all the glass is half full here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a fair point. I mean, there's certainly a lot of variability, and you know, aquifers are not perfectly mixed basins or bathtubs, right? There are hydrogeologic controls that we can't account for. But I think that when you start to look at overall what's occurring in a basin, which is what I'm showing on this slide, so this table outlined in red shows basins in which there are far more wells with increasing trends relative to decreasing trends. Right, and so Coralitos Pajaro Valley, Salinas Valley 180-400, Salinas Valley Eastside, Salinas Valley Forbay, Salinas Valley Langley, and Santa Maria all have far more wells that are with increasing trends than decreasing trends. And so particularly concerning is Salinas Valley 180-400, 29 wells with statistically significant trends, 93% of those 29 wells show increasing trends. Santa Maria, 59 wells with statistically significant trends, 69% of those wells show increasing trends. So I agree that there is a lot of variability, but when you start to look, compare the number of wells that are increasing to decreasing, it starts to draw a clearer picture.
But what I'm suggesting is there's lessons to be learned where, for example, San Luis Valley, you have 70% of decrease and only 30% of increase, and I guess all I'm saying is, what triggered that? And maybe we can bottle that, so to speak, and bring
I think that's a
magic recipe.
I think that's a great question. I mean, it's certainly beyond...
you know, San Inez River, same thing. You know, 79%, almost 80% decrease, 20% increase.
Yeah.
They're switching to grapes.
He's blaming it on grapes, but...
I mean, the good news is there are some basins that do show improving water quality. I mean, I think that's a good message to take home. We'd like to see that. However, our agriculturally dominated basins are generally showing decreasing water quality. So the next analysis we did was this nitrate paired sample comparison. And again, this is we wanted to utilize the irrigated lands regulatory program that we'd been requiring growers to submit. And the way we did this is we compared the concentration measured in a well in fall of 2012 to the concentration measured in the same well in fall of 2017. We tried to control for seasonality by only looking at samples collected in fall. We didn't want to introduce some seasonal variability that confused our interpretation. And we also looked at wells that are 5 years apart so that there was enough time difference such that we could see meaningful changes in concentration. And then we tested for statistically significant differences between these 2012 and 2017 groups. And we used only ILRP wells. And this gave us, because of the constraints we put, it gave us a limited data set. And as such, we can only do a region-wide comparison. We can't do a basin-by-basin comparison. But this is the result of that paired sample comparison. And so these black dots on this plot are all individual wells. The concentration in fall of 2012 is indicated on the vertical axis. Concentration on fall of 2017 is shown on the horizontal axis. And so the way you read this is you take an individual well, such as this one, you read off its concentration in 2012 over here on the vertical axis. It's about, we'll call it 5 milligrams per liter. Its concentration in fall of 2017 was about 60 milligrams per liter, which you read off down here. And so it showed an increase of about 55 milligrams per liter between 2012 and 2017. This black line running diagonally is the y equals x line. And so if a well had the exact same concentration in 2012 and in 2017, it would plot along this black line. If the concentration was higher in 2012, or in other words, if it decreased through time, it's going to plot on the left side of this line. And if the concentration increased through time, it's going to plot on the right side of that black line. And so you can see there's a lot of these wells that are plotting on the right side of that y equals x line, suggesting that many more wells increased in concentration through time. This linear regression basically is looking at the relationship between fall or the 2012 and 2017 concentrations. And the regression predicts that concentrations are going to be higher in 2017 relative to 2012.
Okay, so I understand what you just told me, but I'm trying to make sense of the cluster in the lower left.
Sure. So these are wells that showed relatively small changes, right? And so certainly these wells here showed a decrease in concentration through time. So it's not unequivocally bad. There are certainly some wells that improved. And it's just showing that there's more wells that did not improve. There's more wells that showed decreasing water quality in general. And again, there's a lot of variability, and this is throughout the entire region. So, this is just another approach to try and see if we can confirm what we saw with the trend analysis shown in the previous slide. And so the results of this region-wide comparison, I tested for statistical significance. They're not statistically significant. This result is a pattern. However, that pattern indicates that region-wide, the concentrations in 2017 are generally higher than in 2012. And this is a second line of evidence suggesting that concentrations are increasing. Yeah. So finally, I'm just about to the end. I'm going to show one last analysis we did, which is a grouped comparison by basin. We compared, again, fall of 2012 to fall of 2017. And we're comparing the concentration measured in wells in 2012 to the concentration measured in all wells in 2017. This is a basin-by-basin comparison. We're testing for significant differences between 2012 and 2017. And it's a much larger data set because we're not requiring that sample pair, right? So the one caveat is that we are comparing concentrations in different wells. We're taking a group from 2012, all the wells in 2012, comparing it to all the wells in 2017. Some of the wells in 2012 may not be in the 2017 group, and vice versa. However, because we have larger sample sizes, we're effectively looking at kind of the central tendency of the 2012 group and comparing that to the central tendency of the 2017 group, right? And again, this used only ILRP wells. So this map shows the results of that analysis. The colors indicate the mean concentration difference between 2017 minus 2012. So positive differences are shown by your warm colors, your yellow, your orange, your red. That indicates an increase in concentration through time. And so you can see nearly all the basins in the region, with the exception of Paso and San Antonio, show an increase in concentration through time. We tested for statistical significance, and we find that three of the basins have statistically significant increases in concentration through time. This is Salinas Upper Valley, Salinas 18400, and San Juan Bautista. So again, these are the basins where we're already seeing severe impairment by nitrate, and we've got a third line of evidence that suggests that concentrations are increasing. So just to summarize this analysis, most basins show a pattern of increasing concentrations from fall 2012 to fall of 2017. Salinas Upper Valley, Salinas Valley 18400, and San Juan Bautista area all have statistically significant increases. The Paso Basin and San Antonio Creek Valley both show decreases in concentration from 2012 to 2017. And this provides us a third line of evidence suggesting that groundwater nitrate concentrations are getting worse in many basins in the region. Yes, please. No, it's not. All right, so this is my last slide. I'm gonna conclude, and these are the major take-home points that I'd like to convey. First of all, groundwater contamination by salt and nitrate is widespread and severe. Second of all, nitrate concentrations are increasing in many of the basins. More frequent data collection and a dedicated groundwater monitoring network would allow us to better detect changes in groundwater contaminant concentrations. And I just want to emphasize that shallow groundwater is young. It reflects impacts from recent land use practices. And so the portions of the aquifer sampled by domestic wells are reflecting recent land use practices. And the biggest point is that we must control nitrogen loading. I mean, this is really the take-home message. And Arwen is going to discuss this more tomorrow in her talk. But I'm going to give away some of your punchline. And what the work that Monica and Arwen has done has showed that the amount of nitrogen left on the ground after crop harvest is large. It's in oftentimes hundreds of pounds per acre. It would only take a small fraction of what's left on the ground to leach to groundwater to cause significant impairment. And we suspect that it's more than just a small fraction that's leaching to groundwater.
So on the wells that you showed, do we have any differentiation between shallow wells and deeper wells? You do mention shallow equals younger groundwater and younger groundwater recharge. I think that's what, you know, you were implying. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, if we take 2017 was a very heavy year of rainfall, mm-hmm. you know, about 150% of average. That's what got us out of the historical 5 years of drought. So I would expect in the shallower wells to have an improvement, a decrease. And so when I was, you know, looking and pointing out some areas where you had a significant decrease versus increase, in your review, did you see, I don't know if you have well depth data, but perhaps that could be part of an explanation.
Yeah, I think that's certainly conceptually sound. That isn't something that I was able to tease out of the data. I didn't see that effect. I think there's a lot of variables that may be confusing the signal, right? So depth of groundwater is gonna greatly affect mm-hmm. the time at which you're able to see a signal from the ground, right? And there's just a lot of basin-to-basin variability, but with respect to your initial question about the domestic well depths, I think that, you know, we are seeing in the shallow groundwater continued ongoing impairment, which is reflected in this slide, right? This is our domestic well aquifer, and we're seeing continued ongoing impairment of this shallow depth, which suggests that it's current ongoing practices that are contributing to that.
So, you know, a question I was going to ask, and I'm not sure if today is the right time, you know, with the various speakers, but are we considering leveraging water aging as another means of seeing what's going on between older water and younger water, and would be part of some of these explanations? Is it up to one of the other speakers who could comment on that, or is this an appropriate time? I'm not sure.
I think age dating is certainly on the table, though. I mean, I think that after you see Arwen's talk tomorrow, you may decide that you don't really need to measure the groundwater because we know that the loading is so high anyway, right? But I think that there are some we are moving in the direction of sampling groundwater for age.
Well, I think certainly as part of Sigma, it's very important.
Yeah.
You know, if you're extracting 200-year-old water, that tells you one thing. If that water is 10 years old, that's another thing. And if you test the water and it's 5 years old and it has high level of nitrates, you cannot say, well, that's legacy pesticide, legacy fertilizer, pardon me, from, you know, many generations ago. So I actually think there's a lot to be learned from it.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that'd be provided some really useful information.
So that concludes
thank you.
James's talk. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
At some point, some future point, I'd like to hear what anybody knows about the impact of nitrate concentrations on uranium leaching into groundwater in the Central Coast. It's the first I've heard of that, and I don't want to spring it today because I know we're focused today, but at some point I'd like to hear.
We'll take note of that. Thank you, Board Member Johnston.
All right, next.
So I want to take a little change of direction here. We received a request, as the chair knows, for 15 minutes for Perry Clausen of Central Coast Groundwater Coalition to provide a presentation on groundwater data from CCGC. We thought this was actually the best place because it matches well with the previous talk. Mm-hmm. This is the best place to plug that in.
You said 5 minutes?
15 minutes.
Oh, that's right.
No, I think it's about three, actually. There you go. Right there.
Oh. Okay, I have to talk really fast then. All right, again, Perry Clausen, Executive Director of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition. And I wanted to give you some of the data that we've collected, too. I guess I'd characterize it as a miniature look at what you just heard. We haven't been around as long, obviously, as the data set that was just covered. Our organization right now has about 372 members, 216,000 acres in the program that stretches from Santa Clara County all the way down to Santa Ynez, so it encompasses the whole Region 3. We're trying to provide a cost-effective approach for our members to comply with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program groundwater monitoring option, and we'll hopefully be here to assist in development in the groundwater component of the next order of 4.0. So we've sampled a good portion of the wells that were mentioned earlier. Since we started in 2013, we've sampled a little over 1,500 wells, 826 domestic, 700 irrigation wells. We completed our work plans for 2.0. We created some contour maps that I want to go over quickly. We developed those for a somewhat different reason than I'm going to be talking about today. In 2.0, we would put forward an idea of using contour maps of existing information to try to enable our members to not sample. We weren't able to get the level of confidence in the contours to justify that, but they still provided some very good baseline information. We've also, in this more recent program, been helping growers comply with their total nitrogen applied reports, and I think we're showing that a coalition approach can work on the Central Coast. So in 2013, we started with our characterization of the groundwater using data from our member wells and also a number of data sets that were available. GeoTracker Gamma, USGS, Lawrence Livermore had some data that we used, our member wells in 13 and 14 that were sampled. Plus, we had access to the irrigated land samples that were done in 2013 and 14. We came up with a kriging approach. It's another common way to show data. This is, and I'm going to show just quickly, you've seen these before in years past, and they are in the public record. But this gives a little bit different look at what the levels are throughout these regions. It certainly does indicate there are areas in the data set from that period I'm talking about where we did have levels in that were below the drinking water standard. Conversely, there are areas, and in my mind was overlaying with the maps we saw earlier, pretty close to what was showed previously in the other presentation. Pajaro Valley, same thing. We have areas below the MCL, but also others that are above. Gilroy Hollister, there's a couple of areas that do have some pretty high levels of nitrates. The San Luis Obispo area. We're about in the center of that map right now, where our current location is, Paso Robles Valley, Santa Maria Valley, that's the northern highlighted area, and then you can see the Santa Ynez Valley and Lompoc on the left, Santa Ynez Valley on the right, where it, as the data indicated there, earlier, are fairly low levels of nitrates. And then, excuse me, the Cayama Valley, and then finally the Montecito Carpinteria area.
A quick question. On these maps, I always get confused. There's one.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. There's one, depending on how you show the nitrogen, there's two different MCLs.
This was 10 is the MCL.
Thank you.
Okay, you're right. We did change that earlier. Okay, so the blue is blues and greens are below the standard. I'm sorry, blue, green, and yellow. Long ways away to see that without that. and then the warmer colors are above. So the number. Go ahead.
The light yellow is.
The lightest. Yes, and the blues are. Yes. So the warmer colors are above the MCL. The blues and very light colors are below the MCL. Okay, you want me to go over you want to see them again, or you can refer back to these later. So this year, or in 2017, we put forward a proposal that was adopted by the regional board, by the executive officer, where we're splitting up our sampling for irrigation and domestic wells. Our members were able to do one sample each of those in 2017, and then the second sample in 18 and 19. As mentioned earlier, we are providing assistance to members on filling out their TNA reports. And then the domestic well sampling, we're continuing on the same approach that we did early on. I guess the punchline for our problems is that we want to make sure that people drinking that water are drinking safe water, are having an alternative. And the irrigated lands members, coalition members, and I'm sure the independent growers or individual growers are providing the bottled water for these areas that are above the drinking water standard. We have performance metrics similar to the earlier program, to where when we find out about the results within 48 hours, we are notifying our members to make sure that they have notified the occupants. I've got a slide at the end, it'll summarize that a little bit better. But one thing we wanted to do, and I came up with this idea when I heard about this session, was let us look at some of the data, a limited data set, obviously, of a first sample and a second sample that we took in the early part of the program compared to the more recent sample. So this is a little bit different way to look at it, but I'll give you the reasons why a little bit later. So the first sample was taken in 2013 through 16, and the second camp sample could have been from 14 to 17. So we're not comparing years to years, we're comparing two samples taken from the same well. So it's a different way to look at it, and we're not trying to do anything with the data other than say, let's look at one sample and then a second sample at the same well. And so we were able, through our data set from 2.0 in the current sampling, to find 506 domestic wells that we have the data for that was sampled twice, and irrigation wells that were sampled twice, again, in those time periods. And the data includes both the nitrate as N and the nitrate as nitrite. And so for those of the statistical analysis world, I did not take that in college, so I must profess that I'll let you that understand this to know that we use two different approaches, statistical analysis approaches that are conventional, and we're able to get a pretty high level of confidence from those analysis, and you'll see that in some of these later slides. But what we did, just the observations, I'm not going to say this is a trend analysis, I'm not going to not characterize this as what it is not, and that is a trend analysis or an elaborate analysis. But observations of data show that wells range from zero non-detects to 180 milligrams per liter in the 13-16 first sample set, and then the second sample was zero non-detect to 204 milligrams per liter. I guess that two obvious observations. The second sample was slightly higher than the first, or significant, however you want to look at that. But also we found that there were significantly more non-detects in the second sample. What does that mean? I don't know. It means the water was better the second time, but just looking at the numbers with a high level of confidence, there were more non-detects, but there were more higher levels. So that's one observation that was made from the domestic wells. Then the similar observation made from the 575 irrigation wells, a little bit lower overall numbers, again, I'm sure in part because they are deeper wells, at more mixture of the waters through these screened intervals. But again, the second sample had a higher maximum number, but again, more non-detects in that second sample. And this just gives you a different way to look at it. What we collected, again, this is our data set. So we had 365 wells below the MCL and 210 wells above the MCL. These are irrigation wells. So in our data set of our members, not differentiating them necessarily in practices or otherwise, but just the members that are in our coalition, more of the wells were below the MCL in irrigation, similar trend or a similar observation in the domestic wells. So this showed more below the MCL than above. And then another way to look at that was the maximum concentration ranges. Wait a minute, did I do this twice? I think I did it twice. My apologies. Okay, the things that I just wanted to point out, two points don't make a trend. Obviously, with two sets of first and second samples, some close together, others. This is not a trend analysis. Some wells had more than two samples that were a second sample. Or some had four samples, so we just chose first and last, and then the time between first and last varied. There's a lot of things to consider in nitrate concentrations. As was explained earlier, it's a very complicated story. And then one more quick thing, talk about with our domestic well follow-up samples. We have 506 members with domestic wells, and of those wells, 95 were above the MCL, 182 were below. So as you follow the third set of squares, 19 wells were new. I put in my air quotes, new wells, and the caveat was 8 wells were sampled for the first time by us. And then another 11 wells were previously sampled by us. So what those new wells indicated is that we hadn't sampled them before, so they had new notifications that need to be made. And then the 76 wells had previously been followed up in the 3.0 or in 2.0, so we were already they had already been notified of their exceedances, and then we did follow up. And then just a general observation that we found starting in 2013, more than half of our members had already been providing replacement water, because this obviously is a problem that's been around for a while. So many of our members had already been providing bottled water before it came up in 3.0 and 2.0. So that's just a summary, way to look at data, a smaller data set, and something that we felt might be add to the conversation here today.
No, I don't have any questions. Thank you for the presentation. It was very interesting.
Yeah, thank you also. I was trying in my head to, and I guess, you know, it's two different set of data. I was looking at your information, the information before, and has there been any attempt to see how they compare, you know, overlaying the maps? Because it seems like we have a little bit of a two sets of data here, and maybe we are arguing over, you know, little percentages here and there, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I will say that Perry's working from a smaller data set, and James is working from a larger data set.
For sure.
James's data set includes Perry's data set, but a lot more data, too. So it gives it, you're talking about two different pictures. James's data set is a more holistic look of the basin, both aerially and vertically.
Pardon?
It's a larger sample.
Sample. I think the good news in both instances, the amount of information being collected, you know, because I look back at when we started, you know, we have very little information, and as the time goes by, you know, we're building these data, and so I think that's encouraging, the fact that we have well monitoring both for drinking water, for irrigation, and we start building the database, because you cannot manage what you don't measure. And so, you know, we understand, when I say we, I guess maybe I should speak for myself, there's a lot of, it wasn't me, there, or maybe I'm told to, you know, I think that we everyone recognize, staff, that there are a lot of variables, but that is why it's important to, over time, you know, have a larger amount of data sets, because then we can track a little bit better what some of these variables would be. But want to acknowledge the work done by your organization, and, you know, thank you for your presentation.
Well, let me add one more thing. Just personally looking at maps as a layman, the contour maps tend to be a little easier to understand. And I think with a data set like you just saw on a contour map, a zoomed in contour map, can be more, I think, more assistance in people understanding where they land on in these areas. When you, and the contour maps were of shallower wells, so that is one thing to point out. 400 feet in the upper aquifers, it was 400 feet shallower. But it's just, I wanted to bring that up because we spent a lot of money on them. I wanted to make sure that they get fed into the conversation somewhere, because contour maps were used in a lot of areas around the world, and it's just another way to look at data versus the circles and the indications.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate this clarification. Mm-hmm. All right. And perhaps maybe another round of presentation and then a break. What's your pleasure?
So the next presentation is 15 minutes. Maybe we look at a break after that.
Yeah, that'll be perfect.
So I'm going to call up to the podium Cheryl Gill from the Department of Pesticide Regulation. So our next speaker is Cheryl Gill. Cheryl is the Groundwater Program Manager at the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. Cheryl has worked in DPR's Environmental Monitoring Branch for over 18 years. 13 years as a scientist and supervisor with DPR's surface water program, and then the last 5 years as the manager of the groundwater protection program. Prior to coming to DPR, Cheryl was an agricultural biologist and weights and measures inspector with the Lake County Agricultural Commissioner's Office. She holds a master's degree in pest management from UC Davis, and she will be presenting information to the board on DPR's groundwater monitoring and regulatory programs. Thank you, Cheryl. I'm sorry.
Okay, good afternoon. Today my presentation will be about DPR's groundwater monitoring and regulatory programs. When I give these presentations, I like to start with DPR's mission statement, kind of just to help make sure everybody's kind of on the same page as to where DPR's authority lies and how we regulate, especially as we start talking about water quality. So when we go into our mission statement, our mission is to protect human health and the environment by regulating pesticide sales and use and by fostering reduced risk pest management. So the key words here are sales and use. And that's where we regulate, sales and use. We regulate what is sold here or what is registered here in California, and we also regulate how that is used. So when it comes down to protecting water quality, our regulation comes through regulating how the pesticides are used and getting protective management practices or mitigation measures either put onto labels of the pesticides themselves or put into regulation as part of permit conditions for then the use of those pesticides. Okay, it's something that's a little bit different about our groundwater program as opposed to our surface water program or our air programs is that our program is completely mandated. That means there's a set in law that gives us pretty much our marching orders in very prescriptive way, very well laid out and direct. So this was the Pesticide Contamination Prevention Act that came about because of widespread detections of the fumigant DBCP in groundwater in the late 70s and early 80s. And this resulted in the passage of then AB 2021 in 1985. And so the purpose of this law was to prevent further pollution of groundwater due to agricultural uses of pesticides. So the two key words there are prevention and agricultural. So there's a lot of work that goes into our program on the front end of preventing pesticide pollution. And then also the focus here is on agricultural use of pesticides. So there's also language in this law that describes legal agricultural use, which gets a bit confusing to some people, but it's kind of our jargon way of maybe saying water board equivalent of non-point source. So this particular law that governs our program deals with mostly non-point source contamination. So this is growers making applications to the ground following normal legal label language. This doesn't really apply to other instances of more point source contamination, such as spills or manufacturing or something like the use of chemigation without appropriate backflow devices. Things like that aren't really covered as part of that. Those are covered in other areas and by other agencies. So this law became parts of the Food and Agricultural Code, and when this went into effect in 1985, it's remained pretty much unchanged until 2014. We were able to get in and get a few small changes that ended up being pretty important for us. But once something's in statute, it's extremely hard for a state agency to be able to get in and modify that in any way. So within this law, we have what I call six or seven major areas of responsibility. The first part was for us to obtain environmental fate and chemistry data for agricultural pesticides before that they were registered. So this also worked retroactively, so we also collected data from pesticides that were already regulated. So as part of those environmental fate data, so things like half-life and solubility, and then we were required then to take those environmental fate data and identify pesticides with the potential to pollute based on physical chemical properties. So now in regulation, we have what we call our groundwater protection list or our groundwater or our 6800B list after the code section it is. That's our list of pesticides that have the potential to pollute. They haven't not yet been found, but they have a potential. And so the next step, the law required us to sample wells for the presence of pesticides. So the bulk of our sampling is focused on those pesticides on that 6800B list. And then once we sample, we're supposed to obtain all that data and also collect data from other agencies. Any agency that collects pesticide data in groundwater is required to report that data in a timely fashion to us. So we take that data, And we're supposed to store it in a database. So we have a well inventory database that dates back to the 1980s. And then every year we publish what's called the well inventory report. Initially, we were supposed to go before the legislature and present this report of anything that had been detected in groundwater during the previous year. But now we're just required to post it annually on our website. So for any new pesticide that's detected in groundwater, this law spells out a very formal review process for our director to review the uses of these pesticides to determine whether or not the pesticide can still be used, and if it can still be used under what conditions. And then if the director determines that the pesticide can still be used and not further prevent or pollute groundwater, then we're to adopt use modifications to protect the groundwater. And then there have been 7 pesticides that have gone through this review process and come out the end. So now there's regulations in place to restrict their uses in some way. And that becomes what's now the 6800A list or the restricted materials. So DPR is monitoring programs. While the law tells us we must monitor, it gives us no authority to require anyone to give up the water. So it's completely voluntary on the well owner's part. So this means we do a lot of going door to door and begging and hope people will let us in to take a sample. And as you can imagine, with the general public, we get every scope of response to our request. We typically focus on shallower domestic wells. There have been other agencies that have different sampling regimes. They may grid up the entire state and then take one sample from each one sample from each grid point to kind of cover the whole geographic area, or others have focused their sampling on getting the most people and characterizing groundwater quality for the most people. But for us, we've always focused on the shallow domestic wells, and we also focus our sampling in the areas of highest pesticide use. So we have a fantastic resource in our pesticide use report data that we're able to go back in time and look very closely, and we know what has been applied when and where, and that really drives where we do our monitoring. And so most of our projects fall into 3 general categories. The bulk of them fall into our groundwater protection list monitoring, our 6800B list. This map is just an example of a project we just finished up in the rice growing country. We sampled 200 wells in and around rice country, and we selected a suite of pesticides to look for that were all used in rice. So we may focus on a region, or we may also focus specifically on a single pesticide and then move throughout the state to look for that. We also have a well network. This is in the Fresno and Tulare County area. It's about 70 wells that we've been sampling since 1999. The original purpose of this was to track trends. So the wells that were all put into this program were wells that had known pesticide contamination. And all of them were pesticides that were currently regulated, and all of these wells are in regulated areas. The idea was to help us determine whether or not our regulations were working and whether or not concentrations were increasing or decreasing. And we've also come to find out that this is also a good area for us to look for new contaminants, because we already have a relationship with these well owners and they let us on to their property, and so we're able to sample for new pesticides we may be concerned about. And right now we're really hoping to expand this network and go areas outside of Fresno and Tulare. In this area, the Central Coast, we would love to set up a network, so that's on our agenda to get done. Our third category of monitoring is what I kind of group all of our other monitoring into, what I call follow-up monitoring. So DPR typically follows up on all reported detections of pesticides in some way or another. So we do a lot of work to go back and resample wells with reported detections. So these detections may be ones that we've found or detections by other agencies. This is also a time when we go back and look for known contaminants that are about to go through our regulatory process. And one example from the Central Coast right now is sampling for DCPA or the pesticide Dacthal here in the Central Coast. That's why we came back here recently. So all of our well sampling data goes into our database. It's always been publicly available, but before you had to get a public records request to do it, but now we've been able to get it all posted online. So that is available. Our IT support isn't the greatest, so it's a little bit clunky, but it is there, all accessible to the public. And we also share this data with the State Board, and they have included portions of it in their GeoTracker database. So it's available there as well. And then our annual well inventory report, that's one I said we used to give to the legislature and is now posted on our website. That's where we describe all pesticides that were detected or reported in the year before, and then also what DPR did about them, not just that they were reported, but what our response was. So if we find something new in groundwater, we have a very well laid out detection response process. We do follow up on all reported detections. I mean, they may get different types of follow-up depending on what it is. So detections of known and currently registered contaminants may trigger adding new regulated areas, or detections of brand new pesticides trigger our detection response formal review process. So part of this is the detections have to be confirmed before we enter into a regulatory process. We have to have a certain burden of proof on us to show that those were true detections. So this means following up with a second confirmed, a second detection or analysis from a second lab or a second analytical method. And also then our legal agricultural use determination to show that these were truly a result of legal agricultural use and not a point source. So this detection response process, it's a formal process, it's about a year long in total. And it begins with us notifying the registrants that they're, or the chemical companies that their products have been detected in groundwater, and it ends with a director's decision. So the registrants then come and present their defense at a series of public hearings before a subcommittee of our Pesticide Registration and Evaluation Committee. And this subcommittee is made up of a representative from DPR, the State Board, and OEHA, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. So then that subcommittee reviews all the data and then makes a recommendation to the director. And then the director makes a final determination. And his determination, they give us four categories that it can fit into, and that his decision can range anywhere from cancellation to requiring use, restriction, modification, management practices, or in the case that he determines that the pesticide hasn't polluted, then just to continue to monitor to assure that concentrations don't reach higher levels. So pesticides that have been through this process and have come out in part of our 6800A list, their use is regulated in groundwater protection areas, they're regulated by the agricultural commissioner's offices. And there are required management practices that are part of the permit or as part of the notice of intent the growers call in before they make an application. And there are also some additional management practices that are required for applications to rights of way or roadsides, and also then statewide some restrictions on use in canals and recharge basins. In addition to the regulated use, we also have what we call our groundwater protection area. These are areas that are identified in regulation as susceptible or vulnerable to groundwater contamination. So these are 1 square mile sections of land. And we typically develop these groundwater protection areas based on one of two ways, either through modeling based on soil types and characterization of the soil, or detections of any of the 6800 A-list pesticides automatically triggers a groundwater protection area.
I'm sorry, so these are statewide, not just in the Central Valley, right?
Right, yeah, they're all over. The map is a little bit off.
That's fine.
Yeah, sorry. So now I move into Region 3 specific things. The dots on the map, the red dots are areas or wells that DPR has sampled in the Central Coast, and the green dots are those submitted to us by other agencies, probably mostly likely drinking water program now at the State Board, but also some from USGS and the State Board's GAMMA program. So in Region 3, those 6800 A-list pesticides, very little use. Relatively in this region as opposed to, say, the Central Valley. The one exception, I guess the highest, it's not really an exception, but the highest use is simazine, and that's on wine grapes, and then diuron, which the highest use is in the rights of way. So as a result, mostly of this lack of use, there's very few confirmed detections of any of the 6,800 A-list pesticides anywhere in the Central Coast. And none of those that we have detected have exceeded established health standards at all. And I did call over to the Monterey County Agricultural Commissioner's Office to kind of see how they regulated pesticides in their groundwater monitoring, or in their groundwater protection areas. And we sort of went back in time and looked at the pesticide use report data and found that in the last 5 years, they had only had one single application of a restricted use material in a groundwater protection area. So really, they don't enforce it at all because there's very little use. So that brings us then to chlorothalidimethyl, or DCPA. So while there is very little detection of the 6,800 A-list pesticides, we have had a lot of detections in the Central Coast of DCPA, which is a pre-emergent herbicide known by the trade name of Dacthal. The major uses are coal crops and onions, and it's been heavily used here in the Central Coast since the 1970s. And I kept explaining our response process and how anything new detected triggers our regulatory review process. This one was a bit of an exception because while the parent was never detected, we have been detecting one of the degradates, or TPA, pretty widely throughout the 1990s. But when the PCPA was first written, there was a specific exemption for degradates. It said that degradates, we couldn't pursue the regulatory review process on degradates if the parent had never been detected. So when we were able to get in 2014 and alter the PCPA, then we removed that degradate exemption, so we were then able to go forward with the regulatory review process for Dacthal. And as a result of that, we came back out here and began monitoring again to get some more recent data to kind of help inform the subcommittee. And in that more recent round of detections, we've had 3 wells total that have exceeded a US EPA's health advisory level of 70 parts per billion. One of the wells was in the Salinas area near Greenfield, and then we had 2 more wells, and then a third that was close, down just on the just below the county line from San Luis Obispo into Santa Barbara in the Santa Maria area. And so now we have triggered our regulatory review process, and the public hearings are now scheduled to begin in August and September. Like I said, the registrants have been notified. We're beginning the hearing, and we expect a final decision around the time frame of October or November of what regulatory action may come out of these detections. And so this is just a map of where those detections were. The yellow dots are old sampling data that did not exceed the health advisory level. The green dots are recent sampling data that also did not exceed the health advisory level, but the red dots did exceed the 70 parts per billion. And I was also asked to talk about emerging issues or things we're newly concerned about. And just within the last year or two now, we've started detecting imidacloprid in wells in the Central Valley. When I wrote this slide, it said 14 wells. I think we're up closer to 25 or 30 now. We've also gotten some information from the USGS that they've also detected imidacloprid. So we're now in the process of confirming these detections and going back and resampling wells. But based on the geographic distribution of these wells, I'm thinking there's a pretty good chance that we will reach an legal agricultural use determination for these. And so far, all of the detections have been pretty well below the health reference level that was established by DPR of 243 parts per billion and the US EPA's chronic human health benchmark of 360. So like I said, we're likely to trigger the review process on these. And we're still confirming them and going back, but we now think we've had several detections in the Central Coast, I think in the Santa Maria area as well. With that, I'm finished.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And it is very helpful to hear kind of basic approach and basic elements of your program, because mm-hmm. we have been fortunate to grow our relationship and our collaboration with DPR through the irrigated ag program. Mm-hmm. So it's very helpful to us to hear directly from you. I'm curious, and you may have told us, and I just didn't understand it, but there are 6,800 pesticides listed that are sold in California.
No, that's the code section, or the regulation
okay.
is 6,800.
So 6,800
is the list of pesticides that have been detected and reviewed and are now regulated in some way.
Okay.
And then 6,800 B list is those that, based on their physical chemical properties, have a potential to pollute.
Okay.
And those make up the focus of our monitoring program.
Okay. So when you take samples, are you taking, or is the lab process one that just looks for everything that is allowed to be sold in California?
No, an analytical screen that huge is just
would be huge.
Almost impossible. So some studies we focus on one thing, so we'll analyze for one pesticide only. But often, along with that, we'll do our herbicide screen that contains the other 6,800 A-list pesticides. But now, since it's getting harder and harder to get out and get the field work done and get cooperators to allow us to sample, we try and take as many samples as we can at the well. And we have developed a multi-analyte screen that has several pesticides on it, more pesticides than before, but still we're not able to sample for nearly as many as we would like.
Yeah, and that, I expected you were going to say that, but I just needed to hear you explain that. And then, can you clarify for me, how do you then identify new pesticides? How does that happen if you're testing for one, or you're looking?
Well, right now, the 6,800 B, you mean that we find new things?
New things.
When we begin monitoring for it, or we get it added to our analyte screen.
And what triggers that? Is it sales?
It's a combination, because right now there's 100 things on the 6,800 B list.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I didn't mention is one of the other revisions to the PCPA was it allowed us to change for the first time.
Oh.
They told us in statute exactly how we were supposed to determine potential to pollute and which physical chemical properties to use. And and after 30 years of monitoring data, we've come to the conclusion that it wasn't quite right. And so we're now in the process of revising that 6,800 B list to make it a little bit better fit. And so right now there's 100 things on that B list. And so we have to prioritize. So we go through that list. We look at use, how things are used. And every year we try and get a couple of more that we can sample for.
And where do you get that data?
The use data? Oh, all agricultural use of pesticides must be reported through the Agricultural Commissioner's Office, so we have a really extensive database going back to the 80s.
So then if you see an increase in one particular new pesticide that you haven't tested for at all, and is there always let's see if I know how to ask this question. If it's a new pesticide, do you have to create the sampling protocol, or is it set up as part of the manufacturing of a new pesticide?
Well, the registrants are required to submit an analytical method as part of registration, but rarely does it have a detection level that's low enough to be environmentally relevant.
Okay.
And it also, we have a lab, a CDFA, Food and Agricultural Lab, that's our standard lab. We also used to have Fish and Wildlife, but they've since decommissioned their pesticide lab. But so even though a method may exist, it may not be on the instrumentation that those chemists can use. So we do spend a lot of time, and it can cost us several hundred thousand dollars and a year or two of work to get an analytical method established.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. And so you're funded for that, and you have a staff for that.
Yes, but it takes time.
And limited, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, and we do compete with our surface water and air programs for lab time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I guess the last question I want to ask you, and see if I can figure out how to ask this, would you say in recent years there are more new types of pesticides and if that's the case, it's more challenging to...
You mean more, oh, more types to analyze
more?
More
types to analyze, yeah, more
that,
being
developed? That's hard to say.
Developed,
I don't know.
On the market?
We typically get about 10 per year of agricultural pesticides that are registered, and not all of those, maybe one or two, are ones that we're concerned about for groundwater, mm-hmm. based on the...
Okay, thank you. That helps a lot. Thanks.
So just to follow up on what Dr. Hunter was asking, when there's a new pesticide, your determination as to whether to put in all the time and energy required to consider adding it to your list, mm-hmm. is based on a combination of use patterns and physical attributes, like how soluble is it, how sticky is it, what's its potential to migrate?
So
to
adding it to our list, you mean to the groundwater protection list or to our priority list for sampling,
To your priority list for sampling?
Well, everything goes through the initial process and gets put on the 6800B list if the physical chemical properties exceed the numbers or match the numbers that we need to match for potential to pollute. But then, yes, we do have to go through the process of looking really individually at each pesticide and how it's used and where and how much it's used.
So the physical properties would be solubility, half-life, and what it degrades into.
Right. And the initial PCPA, when it was written, it identified persistence and mobility as the two and the physical chemical properties that go into making up how persistent is it in the environment and how mobile would it be in the soil, so how soluble.
So, and then I was a little confused. It looked like, I think one of the slides showed, a dedicated sampling well system in the Central
mm-hmm.
Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But is that really the only place you have that?
Yes.
And everywhere else you rely on the kindness of strangers?
Yeah. Well, no, yeah, we do. The kindness of strangers.
Okay. So is it safe to say that one of your persistent problems in getting in following up in your groundwater program is access to wells for sampling?
Well, usually we're able to get them. It just takes a little while. I mean, if one person tells us no, we go next door, you know,
okay.
and ask them. And so we usually do find enough wells. We are required to get homeowner permission or the landowner's permission. We can't take a tenant or just somebody who happens to be there. It has to be the permission of the landowner. And that did cause us some problem in the Monterey area, because trying to find somebody who is home, who is actually the owner of the land, was a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to team up with Region 3 staff and their recent or their new upcoming monitoring program to see if we can't tag along to some of those sites.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, I know that, how should I say this? The regional board's relationship to agriculture has been fraught at times. It's kind of gone up and down, but as regulators of them, it's been difficult. And we've worked hard on it, and so has agriculture, but it hasn't been easy. Has that been true of DPR as well, or have they had a more copacetic relationship to
well do you
general.
Mean relationship in terms of getting access to wells or
in terms of getting access to wells in terms of whether you're generally seen as the enemy or a friend?
I don't know. I mean, we don't speak directly with the growers usually when we're out, unless one of them happens to answer their door. But I wouldn't say they're any less likely to say yes than any other homeowner. In fact,
okay.
we've had more people turn down wells because they're worried about their property values or worried about having to disclose a contaminated well as part of a sale than we have had someone who appears to be a grower turn
okay.
us down.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, thank you for your presentation. And, you know, one area I think that helps you is the relationship you have with the Ag Commissioners, because you're you know, they're the boots on the ground, they're the one getting all the information. So mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of a difference of the relationship, because Ag Commissioner's Office and DPR, you know, are linked very closely together. Mm-hmm. You know, example is yesterday I attended the UC annual strawberry field day in Santa Maria, and the Ag Commissioner from Santa Barbara, Deputy Ag Commissioner, gave a little updates and mentioned, in fact, that DPR was sampling 3 wells, you know, that week. So I thought, okay, that's very timely, because it shows, you know, you're very active. And then also looking at, you know, details such as recently the tarp used for fumigants on strawberries, and taking sample of these tarps and verifying that there was no escape from the fumigant application. So that was, I thought, also, you know, an indicator that it may not appear perhaps to the public what is happening, but there's obviously a lot of work that goes on. I had a question that, although this presentation today relates to groundwater and pesticides detection in groundwater, but you mentioned that there were 2 specific areas that you performed sampling. One is on wells, and the other one you mentioned canals. So my question was, what about, for example, irrigation drain ditch? Of course, I understand
let me clarify. We don't conduct sampling of canals, but there are groundwater protection regulations that govern the use of certain pesticides in canals and in artificial recharge areas. So we don't sample those. However, there are regulations that restrict the uses of certain pesticides in those areas to protect groundwater quality. So no, we don't.
Okay, because I was going to mention that drain ditches eventually find themselves in through percolation in groundwater. So if there was, you know, certain pesticides found at the surface level, it, you know, they most likely would migrate in the groundwater eventually. So I was just curious to see if you had any program looking at that.
Well, we have a huge surface water monitoring program.
But
we do.
Would this apply?
We don't really combine the two. Maybe it's worth a shot to start looking at things frequently detected in a certain area in surface water.
Yeah, because, you know, in our case, that was the reason of our sequence of having presentations on surface water quality and now moving into groundwater quality, because groundwater quality starts with surface water quality.
Well, but generally speaking, the concentrations in surface water are much lower than any human health levels,
mm-hmm.
Because they tend to regulate at much, much lower levels for protection of aquatic life, which the benchmarks are much lower than the groundwater human health benchmarks.
All right. Well, again, many thanks for coming to San Luis Obispo and share a little bit of the information that you have. You know, we had conversation with some of my colleagues about, you know, the increase, and you mentioned it too, John, collaboration amongst agencies, and I think this is very healthy, because obviously you have information available, and if we can use, when we look at groundwater quality information that you generate and you know, the information we generate, you know, we can make progress in water quality. So it's nice to see this sharing of information. So thank you again. Okay. Appreciate.
Thank you.
So at this time, Mr. Robertson, I think we'll take a break,
And we reconvene in 15 minutes. It'll be 3:45. So thank you very much.